In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We welcome back Heather Lane to the show. She was a guest back in June of 2015, and at that time she was suffering from electromagnetic hypersensitivity, a sensitivity to electromagnetic fields, especially microwave radiation. Symptoms include headache, fatigue, stress, sleep disturbances, skin prickling, burning sensations and rashes, pain and ache in the muscles, and many other health problems. In the years prior to the 2015 interview, Heather had moved around looking for locations that were for the most part free of symptom-producing electromagnetic fields. During that time, very few people were reporting about electromagnetic hypersensitivity. Fortunately, now there is much more information on this topic, and documentaries such as Generation Zapped can provide insight into how ubiquitous wireless microwave radiation is harming biological life on this planet. About 9 years ago on this show, we focused in on the various sources of microwave radiation in our environment, including cell phones, cell towers, and so-called smart meters. In past interviews, guests such as Amy Worthington explained the types of harmful effects from exposure to microwave radiation and radio frequency, such as 24 hours of cell phone use equal 1,600 chest x-rays. It's important to remember that wireless radiation opens up the blood-brain barrier, allowing access for toxins in the blood such as aluminum and sodium fluoride. Most people pressing cell phones to their heads don't realize that the manufacturer had warned users against holding the device up against the body because of the potential health hazards. It was pointed out in a study that some people will feel heat, headaches, and weakness from wireless radiation, but some people won't feel it. Yet in both cases, human red blood cells adversely react to the microwave radiation with effects known as stacking, bottle capping, or their movement slows down. Our guest Heather Lane returns to talk about how she has recovered from the worst of the electromagnetic hypersensitivity, and she expounds on a powerful healing technique called limbic neural rewiring, which is a relatively new field of research. Heather Lane, welcome back to Another News.
Hi, how are you, Jeff? It's great to be back.
Well, Heather, would you please explain the EHS condition to listeners, please?
Electrohypersensitivity is a reaction to signals and frequencies, and sometimes electrical devices themselves. It can be of all sorts. The sensitivity seems to have been precipitated by a huge amount of microwave signals in our environment where previously there were none, and the proliferation of towers and Wi-Fi and all the other wireless items that we all seem to use now has caused a lot of people to kind of have this syndrome where they can start to feel pain or have migraines, and then sometimes it leads to something really palpable, like they can feel the phone in their hands burning or electrocuting feelings from that. The symptoms really vary, and everybody's individual with their presentation, but it does seem like it's connected to microwave signals being so ubiquitous at this point.
Do you think the microwave radiation triggers the condition, or how do people become so sensitive to this?
We have speculated. Nobody can be completely certain if it's the microwaves, but we've definitely speculated there's a connection because, like the bees starting to have their issues with die-off and inability to find their way back home with the frequency interruptions when the towers started to go up, people also started to become symptomatic in different ways. When we all collectively come together and compare notes, it seems like it started to really increase around 2006, 2010, for some people, depending on their geographic location. I think when things went digital, I'm pretty sure the year was 2006. A lot of people say that's when they started to have issues. It has to do also with some of us being more hypervigilant and having what is called a limbic injury. And a lot of people that suffer from these kind of conditions, and also that can include things like mold sensitivity, also chemical sensitivity, a lot of us who have some or all of these wind up having a hypervigilant amygdala, limbic system, and that's caused by, you know, having trauma in the past. So I've come to the conclusion myself, and again, consulted with other people who understand these things and have experienced them, that we kind of have a perfect storm, and all the other people who don't feel these signals and don't have these kind of symptoms, especially to microwaves or electricity in general, are still affected by what those signals and frequencies do to their bodies and to their DNA, but they just don't feel it, possibly because they don't have that hypervigilant neural pathway situation going on in the brain. Another facet of this that has become clear is that many of us who have the sensitivity also present with Lyme disease, which can make your immune system kind of go haywire looking for the culprit, knowing that there's something wrong in the body and not being able to find a pathogen because Lyme is so evasive to the immune system. So when I say perfect storm, it kind of can include all of these things.
Thanks for breaking it down. In your opinion, have you seen an increase in EHS conditions among people you speak with and just that you read about since we last spoke, maybe back in 2015?
I have heard of more people becoming aware of it. And as I said, I do think that some of it is that it has increased, and then also that people are just understanding more about it because there is more information available when people start to have symptoms that they can connect the dots. Those who have more lower-level symptomology don't always get the answers, and they just wind up medicating for migraines or having a diagnosis of a fibromyalgia presentation. Some people have a diagnosis of an MS presentation when their nerve sheathing is affected and they can feel electricity more acutely.
Let me stop you there for a minute, Heather, because you said that really quickly. When their nerve sheathing is thinner, called the myelin sheath, and around our nerves, there's a sheath. It's an insulator to protect the current, the subtle current moving through the nerve. And why would it become thinner?
Demyelination occurs as an autoimmune response. In some people, they have an autoimmune response, like I said, to Lyme and other pathogenic infections that go with the Borrelia, mostly known as tick-borne infections, Lyme and co-infections. That's a big culprit. Other people who have heavy metal toxicity, which all of us are suffering from heavy metal poisoning because of the environment that we live in, and you know, maybe some deliberate methods to poison us with mercury in the environment. And so that's another thing that can sort of cause an autoimmune response and reduce the effectiveness of the myelin sheathing.
Heather, please remind listeners about your case and when you realized EHS was an issue for you and how you initially began to treat it.
In my case, I had undiagnosed Lyme for a period of time, and I was also dealing with a situation, a home situation where I was under duress and in a domestic abuse situation. So my whole immune system and limbic system got really involved in the end. I started to have pain, chronic pain, from all of those issues combined, kind of feeding off each other. And then I began to have more acute symptoms. I remember there was one point where I did feel my cell phone. I felt like it was sort of shocking me slightly. And then at another time, I started to feel the dryer, the clothes dryer. And that made it pretty clear that it was you know, affecting me adversely. And then I couldn't really look at the screens of a computer or a cell phone comfortably. It started to affect my eyes and sort of made my eyes feel like they were being stabbed. So that's how it went for me. And it went from being a pain syndrome that lasted for years to kind of suddenly being really, really obvious that it was so much more than I thought. You know, that I had the misdiagnosis of quote-unquote fibromyalgia, still didn't have a Lyme diagnosis, and then this all started to happen. Jeff, as to your question about treatment, there isn't really a treatment for electrosensitivity. When I started to feel the acute symptoms, the only thing I could really do was attempt to avoid the things that were inflaming me.
Heather, you started to feel symptoms in Vermont, and then you moved from there. Can you explain what you did during that period of time?
Well, I began to feel the symptoms that I described, and then when I figured out that I had a Lyme diagnosis, I decided to head to Portland. I had issues trying to get help on the East Coast, either medically or naturopathically, so I discovered that Portland was a better option for treatment for Lyme disease. And then I just headed over there, headed west, and when I got there, the infrastructure was huge. Towers were everywhere, antenna were everywhere, and that's when it just got kind of off the charts for me. I did suffer what very much seemed like a seizure from a cell tower, and it was pretty devastating. And I just really still was able to function, but I stopped using a cell phone and I started to look for a place without Wi-Fi, and I found one. But my symptoms kept increasing and my avoidance was the only answer that I could find. I did look for something that might treat, and different things were recommended, but none of them seemed feasible. So I was led to trying to shield, basically, and avoid. And that's what many of us discovered we needed to do at that point when we became acutely sensitive.
So you're in Portland, Oregon. You had a seizure from maybe overexposure to microwave radiation. You discovered that among the best methods were to shield yourself from the radiation. You had mentioned in a previous conversation that you had to shield the interior of your car. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, eventually it became so intense for me, especially as I was driving past towers. I could feel a tower at about a half a mile away, sometimes more, depending on the signal that was being emitted and how far flung it was. Also, whether it was a CDMA tower or a GSM tower. So I began to realize that, like, if I was going to travel anywhere, I needed to protect myself in my vehicle. And another person who had electrosensitivity had shielded her car. She just put the aluminum screen over the glass portions of the car to just add to the shielding. But I took it a step further because my symptoms were so devastating at that point that I actually had to make myself like a shielded in cockpit in the driver's seat. And I used like yards and yards of aluminum screen and little T-pins and all kinds of little things. The inside of my vehicle resembled a pin cushion.
Heather, was that effective?
It was. I could see on the meter. I had an RF meter that I used to help gauge my environment. And I could see on the meter that it was decreasing significantly. If there were ever any gaps in the screen, I could detect that with the meter, or if I didn't feel it. I always like to try to detect it with the meter first before I actually felt the symptoms from it, because it was so hard to recover from those symptoms at that point. But yeah, I felt better. It wasn't perfect, but I did feel better, and I was able to drive my car. I kind of was at a point where I needed to travel. I needed to get out of there, and I didn't want to take away all of my independence by having to, you know, stop driving. So that was the solution for me. And again, it was all about shielding and avoidance at that point.
You left Portland. Where did you end up going after that?
I did leave Portland when I seemed that I couldn't escape signal adequately, and my mold symptoms had increased at that point too. So Portland and Oregon in general was not the best place for me at that time. I headed down toward California, and I landed in a place in Northern California that actually seemed pretty different and felt really good. And I felt like I would just want to try to stay here and see if I could find essentially what we call a life zone, but what is known to people who want cell phone signal as a dead zone.
I understand. And are you living in a house? Where are you living?
I found myself unable to find a shelter that didn't affect me in a way that was uncomfortable for me. Whether it was signal, mold, chemical, something like that, there were issues with everything. So I found that the best thing to do was to camp in Northern California, and I did so in a tent configuration.
How long have you been doing that, and what is the progress so far?
I have been at this camping situation for nearly 5 years. It'll be 5 years next month. Interestingly, as I've lived here and recovered from my symptoms, I have also noticed that there is signal here. After doing avoidance and shielding and kind of living in a hermit lifestyle, which was not really tenable, I wound up finding some solutions to help my electrosensitivity and, in fact, reverse it. And since then, the signal has come here. So I am actually in signal now. And I do occasionally use wireless, I can do that because there's signal here now, and also because I can withstand the wireless without symptoms.
The wireless signal did catch up to you, and not only did it catch up to you, but it's going to be even more ubiquitous. The hardware is now building out across the United States and other parts of the country, in Europe, in the UK, Canada. Everyone is getting what's called 5G, 5 gigahertz. The 5G wireless and microwave antennas are being constructed very quickly right now. You can type in 5G build-out, states resist, and feast your eyes on the propaganda. Each of the 50 states are given a protocol by the FCC in how to go forward with one of the most massive microwave infrastructures ever built. Up to 800,000 antennas will be installed. In my opinion, not enough people know about the health impacts to children, pets, migratory birds, insects, bats. I'd like to go through some quotes, Heather, from doctors who had researched the human health effects of 5 gigahertz microwave transmissions. Here's one quote. Human sweat ducts transmit and perhaps also receive electromagnetic waves that reflect the person's emotional state as an extension of the sympathetic nervous system that innervates sweat ducts. Computer simulations have demonstrated that sweat glands concentrate sub-terahertz waves in human skin. Humans could sense these waves as heat. The use of sub-terahertz millimeter wave communications technology, such as cell phones, Wi-Fi, antennas, could cause humans to perceive physical pain through these receptors. And that's Dr. Yael Steins commenting to the FCC. There's another comment by the Maryland Smart Meter Awareness. Do you want to read that one, Heather?
Yes, neither were the American people consulted about whether we would want to sell our health and well-being in exchange for a gain of a few milliseconds in internet speed and an intrusive, cumbersome internet of everything, quote unquote, that would require us to accept cancer-causing radiation-emitting devices on every home or lamppost. And that's from the Maryland Smart Meter Awareness comment to the FCC.
There's another one below that. Can you read that one, please?
Because the frequency used in 5G will be much higher than what has been used for 2G, 3G, and 4G, transmission distances will be much shorter, and the number of small cell sites required will be several times greater than the 300 and 8,000 macro cell towers already in place around the country, and that's from Angela Tsang. And I just want to bring up the point about how the town on Long Island was not consulted about the erection of all of these sites, these little antenna sites on their lampposts and all over their neighborhood. And when they did wake up one morning to find all of that in place, after not being consulted about whether they wanted it or being warned that it was going to be in place, they did start a protest. I guess if listeners want to look that up, what was that town called again? Do you remember, Jeff?
I believe that's Lake Success, Long Island. Here's another quote. One primary criticism of how the FCC functions is that they time average exposures rather than regulate or for peak exposures, which is the most important biological metric. Smart meters, for instance, during the duty cycle, put out a peak burst of RF that has been found to exceed FCC limits by orders of magnitude. Cell phone manufacturers tell consumers not to hold a functioning cell phone against the body, or it too may exceed FCC limits. Yet that peak is averaged away into the duty cycle's lower exposures and essentially disappears into what is deemed, quote, safe. That's like saying that a bullet passing through flesh is safe because it comes out the other side and moves more slowly by the time it passes through the bone, blood, and tissue. The FCC standards are based on a dosimetry model of how to make communication systems work with the least amount of transmitted power necessary, not on true biological models regarding the consequences of living systems in the path of technology. The proposed 5G network will contain peak exposures of its own that will also be lost in the background noise of how FCC regulates. This is the Berkshire Litchfield Environmental Council commenting to the FCC. What do you think about the permanent damage that will be done to humans because radiation is cumulative in the body?
Well, this has been a grave concern to all of us who have been, you know, I guess we could say lucky enough to feel this. Obviously, it's been really hard on us physically and emotionally to have this kind of sensitivity. And for periods of time, it's made my life really difficult. But in the end, I'm grateful because it made me research and understand all of the work and research that has been done behind the scenes and suppressed. Thinking of the work of Dr. Salford and Leif Salford, and he does discuss the rat studies that have been done with Wi-Fi exposure for just a small period of minutes daily within five generations of the rats. They are rendered sterile from that exposure. And the studies about cancer in humans are also showing that there is a great deal of susceptibility for certain kinds of cancer, that people who are smaller, like children, are going to be exposed to more radiation through the entire skull because of the size of their heads when they're growing still. And there's a lot of concern that a lot of the brain cancers that have been developing, the glioma, is caused directly from cell phone use.
I'm glad you brought up Dr. Salford and you pointed me in that direction. He's a neurosurgeon. He wrote a paper titled Nerve Cell Damage in Mammalian Brain After Exposure to Microwaves from GSM Mobile Phones. That's Global Satellite Mobile Phones. From one article, it's written, in laboratory rats, Salford's team has demonstrated that blood-brain barrier leakage occurs only after 2 minutes of exposure. Further, a single 2-hour exposure to a cell phone, even at reduced power, was shown to damage or destroy up to 2% of an animal's brain cells. In other experiments in Salford's laboratory, long-term exposure of rats to a cell phone caused memory impairment, and a single 6-hour exposure at extremely low power levels caused genetic damage. Exposure to a low-frequency magnetic field, low frequencies are also emitted by cell phones, caused disturbances of calcium transport in cells. Salford has called the use of cell phones by human beings, quote, the largest biological experiment ever. And he calls the potential implications of his laboratory results, quote, terrifying. Those who might normally have got Alzheimer's dementia in old age could get it much earlier, he said. Quote, perhaps putting a mobile phone repeatedly to your head is something that might not be good in the long term. He's experimenting on rats, but this research translates to the human brain. And we're talking about the blood-brain barrier, other special organs shielded from the blood requiring a barrier include the testes, the follicle, and the ovary, and the eye. And listeners, if you remember what Heather said earlier in this interview, that she had difficulty looking at a screen. It felt like needles in her eyes. When I heard you say that, Heather, I thought about potential blood barrier breach there.
Yeah, so we do know that generally low signals are breaching the blood-brain barrier and the high signals are breaking DNA. It is the conclusion of many researchers that there's no safe level of microwave radiation. It's doing damage at all levels, basically.
When you see the rat's brain exposed for 2 hours with low amounts of microwave radiation, the distribution of blood-brain barrier breaches are astonishing, especially in the cortex. 1.85 meters away from a cell phone antenna is sufficient to open the blood-brain barrier of a rat. From the towers or base stations, it's 190 meters away from that source. Well, think about that for a minute. Whatever impurities are in the blood are leaching into the tissues of the brain. The soft metals you're breathing in from particulates in the air, sodium fluoride, and just go down the list of toxins in the blood. It becomes clear how the functioning of the human brain can be quickly compromised and succumb to propaganda or become fatigued with the weight of independent thought or long-term research. We go now to hear Dr. Leif Salford. He's a neurosurgeon. And in this clip, he's talking about the strength of the cell phone signal and how that corresponds with the blood-brain barrier breaches in the brains of rats. You'll hear in part of this presentation that very low levels of microwave radiation have a greater effect on the blood-brain barrier breach.
We made a huge amount of experiments for this before 1997, and this was published in 1997 in the Persson et al. Paper. And there's more than 1,600 rats in those days, and we exposed most animals for 2 hours, but a few of them for 2 minutes, 15 minutes, 1 hour, and most again 2 hours, and a few even up to 16 hours. And then they were examined within 30 minutes in almost all the cases, but also in a few cases up to 16 hours after exposure. So this is what it looks like in a control animal, in a sham animal. She sat in this machine, one rat upstairs, one downstairs, and out comes such a control animal. There is always an inbuilt control where albumin here, stained by the rabbit anti-rat albumin, shows that in the hypothalamus you have an area where there is always an uptake, a normal taste, where the brain tastes what is in the blood. So this is normal. It's true also in the human being. We have the same type of area in our brain where there is a free passage without doing harm to us. This is what it looks like when a rat has been there for 2 hours. So if you've been in this cage for 2 hours, been exposed, and this at very different levels, we learned that the rats that had the lowest energy levels, not 1 watt per kilo, not 100 milliwatts per kilo, not even 10 milliwatts per kilo, but 1 milliwatt per kilo, and even 0.1 milliwatt per kilo, are those energies that open the blood-brain barrier most efficiently in our rats. The rats are always Fischer 3-4-4 strain. So here you can see in another rat, there are these areas here more in the cortex, less in the basal ganglia. And here you have a close-up. You can see there is a vessel, and the leakage has been some 7-8 vessel diameters out in the surrounding brain. You can see the same thing down here. This is what I already mentioned. There is a biological window where one thousandth and one tenth of a thousandth of the energy at the antenna, if you look upon that as being 1 watt, opens the blood-brain barrier more efficiently than the energy at the antenna. This picture is a rather complicated one, but the only one I really have. It shows you this is 1 watt per kilo. Really nothing happens. In those old days, we had lots of levels of frequencies. So we had a continuous wave. There were 73 rats in this case. There were those 8, 16, 50, 217 hertz. And then we combined all of them and all the pulsed ones. That came out with not very high significance for this 1 watt per kilo. But if you combine them all, especially continuous waves, you came up to good significances. If then we went down to 0.1 watt per kilo, you get some of these significances, large numbers of rats, as you see, 32, 12, 18, 91, 56, in total 209, and their controls. And then you go down to 10 milliwatts per kilo, basically. And there you can see still not all that much. You can see a lot at 50, not nothing at 217. But then you go down to 1/10 of a milliwatt up to 1 milliwatt per kilo. And here everything is statistically significant. There are 12, 18, 6, 23, 52 animals and their controls, and there was no continuous wave there. But this is what really made me very, very interested in this peculiar field, and that's why I continued to work in it as a parallel to my major studies on the brain tumors, malignant gliomas, which is really my major task of research. We looked into afterwards whether these controls, because there were not personal controls for all those rats that were examined during the first year. So we went back to our material in a publication only a few years ago, where we found out that it was the 0.2 to the 4 milliwatts per kilo that really had a highly significant opening of the blood-brain barrier, while those between 25 and 50 in this case, milliwatts per kilo, didn't come out significantly, though they were somewhat less amount of animals, as you can see. This is very much in correspondence with what the good old people here in America, Oscar and Hawkins, demonstrated in 1977 on the microwaves. Exactly the same thing, very, very low down, 0.4 milliwatts per kilo, that is corresponding to this value here. And they show that under that value, they have this inverse U-curve, which was often referred to by our old friend Rossady as well. We have made some calculations. Where in the brain do you have those energy levels that in the rat, this is the human brain, in the rat are the most efficient openers? You can see if you have 1 watt at the antenna, you have 0.1 here, 0.01 here, 0.001 here, 0.0001 here. So this is the level where the rat's blood-brain barrier is most efficiently opened. And that is in the midline of the brain. And then, of course, if you take a hands-free and took this mobile phone away, you reduce the energy by 100 times, but still having it in your vicinity reaches at least the outer areas of your brain, if I may translate my rat's findings into the human situation. And that's how we started to say this: there is a passive mobile phone exposure. I gave a lecture to the European Union in year 2000. I brought this forward. Its fact is that it's 1.85 meters away from the antenna that you have the energy level, which is correspondent to the one that most efficiently opens the rat's brain, blood-brain barrier. And also, if it's from base stations, it's 190 meters away that you have 1 milliwatt per kilo. It's a long distance, and that's the energy that we have found over and over again is the most effective one. And this is the French telecom, activist, I might say, who say we should really stay at the bioinitiative levels. Don't let us rush up as we do now during these very last years. What harm does then albumin do in the neuropil, out in among the neurons and nerve cells? This is a rather stuffy picture, but it shows research from Lund. It's not my own, it's my colleague in the Department of Neurology, Barbro Johansson, who made a very nice contribution in the late 1980s and early 90s about what happens when albumin comes into the normal brain. You can do it by intracarotid infusion of hyperosmolar solutions into the circulation. There are special rat strains with stroke-prone hypertensive rats. You can have an acute hypertension by compressing the descending aorta in rats. These are, of course, major problems for rats to have these things happen to you. But what was shown over and over again by these people in Lund, in paper after paper, the albumin brain parenchyma, neuronal degeneration, the nerve cells degenerate in all these cases, and also in epileptic seizures, shown in rats, but also in human beings. And there were people who said albumin is the most likely neurotoxin in serum. And the albumin in the brain has been shown by Norwegian, Hassel, long ago now, 94, but he showed that if you injected the rat's own albumin into his brain hemisphere, one of them, there was a starting up of a leakage of endogenous albumin from the rat's own blood system through the capillaries out into the brain, and neuronal damage. Again, a larger trauma than I think that we give them by our mobiles. We went further. In 2003, we published this paper in the Environmental Health Perspectives, that damage to the brain cells. Are there any such damage in our rats? It was a small material, you can see, only 8 animals in each group. It was 2 milliwatts, 20 milliwatts, and 200 milliwatts in 8 animals each. And then we have the sham animals, which were as many. They were allowed to survive for 50 days after 1-2 hour exposure. Then were anesthetized and sacrificed, and the perfusion fixation, as always, in all our animals from the beginning to the end. And then they were examined by a neuropathologist.
That was Dr. Leif Salford, a neurosurgeon, discussing his research on how the blood-brain barrier within the brains of rats are negatively affected by cell phone microwave radiation. Back to the news of the 5G network. 5G will utilize smaller cell stations and the technology of beam forming that will scramble and unscramble and redirect packets of data on a no-interference path back to us. This means wireless antennas on almost every lamppost, utility pole, home, and business throughout entire neighborhoods, towns, and cities. There are epic 5G fights happening not only in Long Island, but in California. Here's one. Residents in San Rafael have launched a preemptive effort to prevent telecoms from installing small cell antennas throughout the city. Well, notice the propaganda of calling 5G structures small cell antennas. That was Kerry Brenner, a writer at the Marin Independent Journal. Good job, Kerry. There's a lot of propaganda amid.
Yeah, it's so funny because it's so painfully obvious to us now. We have a fight going on here in the town that I'm in. I don't know that I want to disclose my town, but it is a small town in Northern California, and we've been successful so far in keeping 5G out. And one of the things that we do bring up is that they're constantly telling us, well, constantly telling the public, the people who use the wireless devices and feel so dependent on them, that they need more, that they need these small ones because they're going to be better. And it's just so suspicious to me that they're bringing these things to every doorstep. And literally, it's like practically on our houses. And there was an anti-landline movement going on from AT&T directly last year where they were sending people these flyers with their bills here. And we were being told that we would have to opt out to not have them come and place electronic equipment, maybe potentially wireless equipment, and replace our landlines with digital phone service here, with wireless kind of phone service. And we were really upset and freaked out that we were going to lose our landlines because there's always we're always under threat to lose the copper landlines at this point. We have to keep an eye on that too. But yeah, basically, all these little antenna everywhere do seem really suspicious to me. I don't think that we need that, and they're trying to convince us so hard that it's going to be bigger and better and more effective and quicker.
Well, it will be, but what they're not doing a good job of is convincing people that it's safe. I think a lot of people realize that that's not the case. They're trying to do it. A writer like Kerry Brenner calling the structures small cell antennas. And they are, but the way she positioned those words in her article made 5G seem innocent and innocuous. Here's another article, Heather. FCC passes order limiting cities' review of 5G deployment. So the FCC is really pushing this ahead. Donald Trump has mentioned that it's a matter of national security to have 5G, and I don't really understand that. The FCC doesn't think assessing deployment of these facilities should be a big deal, since 5G installations are expected to be fairly small in the order. The FCC references a comment describing the 5G wireless units as being able to, quote, fit into a pizza box. That's because 5G will work across a much shorter range than previous wireless technology, so wireless carriers will need smaller units, but it'll need to place a lot more of them. This is troubling because these are used also as surveillance devices.
Right.
Okay. So that means there will need to be a lot of deployments, which offers some reason for why it's important to have a quick process for getting them approved. But the process also applies to new structures that may be needed to hold the units in some cases. And those could be larger, and cities are concerned. The order removes many of the tools they use to preserve the character and health, the emphasis on that word, of their neighborhoods. And it's not only human health, but health of the biology in the cities. The FCC excludes these small cell cities from being reviewed for environmental impacts and impacts on the historical character of an area. It also limits review on tribal lands. The order prevents cities from charging any fees to file deployment applications beyond what it actually costs to review them as well. And I just want to remind you that this is not only in the United States. This is happening in the UK, Canada. Major cities, including Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, wrote to the commission with concerns. Philadelphia wrote that maintaining control over deployments is, quote, essential in order to effectively protect the health, safety, and welfare of the city's nearly 1.5 million residents and 43 million annual visitors. What do you think of that comment, Heather?
There's been a large influx of people who have gotten a lot of awareness. Sometimes I feel a little crestfallen that we're not able to do more and that we have been kind of directed to be distracted and dependent on all of these devices to the point where some people seem to know. They say, oh, I know it causes cancer, but they don't really stop. They don't limit their usage. They don't turn it into cell phone, into airplane mode. And it's just, I don't know, it's really frustrating. I feel good about the work that's being done to raise awareness and fight the powers that be that are just accepting this without even asking any questions or, you know, requiring any kind of testing or, you know, research. But it's a little frustrating for some of us.
Well, looking toward various solutions, one of them you've been using and teaching, and it's an interesting healing technique called limbic neural rewiring. Can you tell listeners about this?
Yes. Ultimately, people want to know, especially in the electrosensitive community, what has helped me. And I became aware of some limbic retraining, or otherwise known as neural rewiring. Sometimes the words are interchanged. And I heard that it was something that was a really good solution. So I became aware that there were some programs, and there was one in particular that was seemed like it was the main one, and so I got a hold of it eventually. It wasn't exactly a perfect fit for me, but it did help me tremendously with the electrosensitivity. I didn't follow it exactly the way that it was prescribed, per se, but I did get amazing results by changing the practice and making it my own to just deal with the hypersensitivity to electronic devices. I mean, I had gotten so bad, as I mentioned in the previous segment, I couldn't even walk, I couldn't even like put my foot over like an extension cord that had any voltage in it. I could feel that. And I could also feel people's cell phones at a distance of a few hundred feet and be able to tell what kind of phone it was. I could differentiate based on the way the frequency felt, whether it was an iPhone or an Android. So I really needed that help. And I also became acquainted with Jolie Jones, and she was in the electrosensitive community. And a lot of people were interested in what she was doing because she's a kind of a public figure. Her father is Quincy Jones, the famous producer. And I managed to contact her through one of our groups and asked her, you know, what it was that helped her because she was doing so much better. And she did say that DVD set was the thing that really turned things around for her. Oh, and by the way, she has a site called JolieTalks.com, which discusses the dangers of wireless and is a great site to link people to if they have any questions or they're just learning about it. So what I learned about the limbic system and the way that it becomes hypervigilant and how we can suffer a limbic injury is that there are neural pathways in the brain, and they can be physically mapped. And when we have neural pathways that we're on that kind of would be considered negative, pathways of illness or trauma, physical pain, emotional pain, they are running the show if we're on them all the time. So they are causing us to kind of repeat and revisit all the trauma and stay in all the illness. When we think about illness or do attribution for certain symptoms to certain types of presentations, pathogenic or otherwise, and dwell on them, those pathways kind of thrive. The neurons in those pathways are firing and therefore wiring together. And so I learned that that was really more the problem for me than anything in the environment, because everybody is exposed to the same things, and some of us feel it and some of us don't. So it became my mission to let go of some of the biological effects and the knowledge of the biological effects, I should say, because I wanted to have more normalcy and needed to, you know, essentially get my life back. And so I did that program, like I said, preliminarily, and I was able to get on a plane and go and do this thing I really wanted to do. I wanted to interview my favorite rock star. And I got to hang out with the band, and it was an amazing experience because I basically went right back into Portland to do this, which is where I had been so sick. So I proved to myself that it was possible and that the work I was doing, DIY, was successful. But then I kind of figured, okay, well, I got that under control, you know, and I went on to move on with my life, but I still had other symptomology and other things going on directly from the Lyme disease that didn't involve sensitivities per se, but that were still causing me discomfort and pain and, you know, emotional distress. So I was still kind of trapped on some bad limbic pathways, and I eventually got some help from a coach and did two or three sessions with her and treated myself in a DIY program of my own devising with her help. I treated myself systemically for everything, for basically having Lyme, for, you know, having different pains in the body and different upsets about traumatizing events that I kept ruminating on. I moved away from all the old neural pathways and created new ones of my own devising with this program. It has been life-changing, and I'm really glad that I took the extra step to get the coaching because the DVD set just wasn't enough for me. It didn't completely drive with me the way it was presented, and I didn't completely finish it because of that. So this is something that I'm doing now to help people. And I take it a step farther because I do the work sliding scale, because I know a lot of us in the electrosensitive and Lyme communities are definitely suffering financially.
You're teaching these methods now. You've been able to have it work for yourself and mastered some of the concepts. I wanted to ask you, however, about the thinness of the myelin sheath. Has this limbic neural rewiring been able to help that? I don't know if you're it's measurable, but could that be helped?
Remyelination can definitely be helped by being on pathways that are more positive. I like to joke that you have to be kind of Pollyanna positive to get this really going, because you do need to take a leap from the old pathways that were exacerbating illness and continuing it, prolonging it, and go into new ones that have nothing to do with illness and everything to do with joy and happiness and, you know, essentially success in your life. I do think that the demyelination symptoms for me have definitely receded. I do other things in the physical world still too. I am not completely anti-supplement, and there are some things that you can do to help with pathogenic infection, obviously, naturopathically, supplemental herbs, things like that. I don't completely turn away from that. I am still a more receptive person. I should say that's the equivalent to the word sensitive, but I like to say receptive because my sensitivity has turned around and become something that I can utilize, because it lets me treat different things more easily than the average person who doesn't feel that receptive / sensitive. But I do like to use certain things that help to remyelinate. But I do think that neural retraining has changed everything. One of the things that the limbic system needs is to be quieted, because it's not supposed to be on like all the time. It's really not supposed to be on unless there's a dire emergency, like, you know, the adage of the saber-toothed tiger.
Okay, I got you. So you're saying that the switch of fight or flight is stuck in the on position?
You're exactly right. That's you're in a constant state of being in fight or flight, which means your adrenals are completely taxed. Adrenal fatigue is caused by this limbic injury. It's another thing that can be completely rectified with neural retraining. And it's not helping the body function in general. Detoxification isn't happening. Digestion isn't happening. Normal thought processes are not happening. You're just in a panicked mode, and your whole body is sort of seizing up. So the lymphatic system is completely backed up when you're not able to detox. It just causes this whole cascade of chronic illness. It's basically, it has more to do with chronic illness than pathogenic infection in truth.
Taking control of the amygdala temporarily in the limbic system, which is an involuntary system, as listeners know, is what the limbic neural rewiring program is about, and that is what our guest Heather Lane also teaches. You have a Facebook page where you interface with potential clients and your clients that are going through this process. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I've had a great opportunity through some work that I did to be in touch with a lot of people in the Lyme community, and a lot of them became Facebook friends, and so I just decided to do this, and I have a page called Heather Lane Limbic Retraining Coach. You can contact me there with questions. I can definitely let you know a little bit more about what I do, and I can also give you an idea of what kinds of work might be necessary to get to the point where you're having this DIY practice of your own. Because my goal for everyone is for us to understand that we're healing from within. We're all responsible for our own healing. And through the coaching, it gets you to the point where you have the confidence and the tools to go ahead and continue forward and be responsible for your own healing. That brings to mind the fact that a lot of us who have been traumatized and have been, say, had narcissistic parents or a spouse with personality disorder, the frequency of electrosensitivity for people who have been traumatized in childhood and continued on in relationships that are abusive is really high. A lot of us who have sensitivities have that in our history. If we're able to find the strength within ourselves and the stability within ourselves to do our healing, then that's a way that we can stop being infantilized by anything external, or some of us will move from a narcissistic relationship or from that kind of abuse in our childhood into the clutches of, say, a narcissistic practitioner. And somebody who is supposedly going to help us heal, but we hand all the power to them, and they wind up taking all our money. And this has happened in most instances of people who have had chronic Lyme that I know of before they find a better way to heal and discover that they have all the answers from within. This retraining is part of finding those answers. Sometimes it's all people need to find the answers. Many times it also brings about manifestations and spiritual growth and starts the ball rolling in a direction that's kind of away from the physical realm or away from dependence on a practitioner for our health. And that's the best thing that I've learned is that really all the answers come from within, and that's one of the things I'm trying to relay to people just by handing them the tools, giving them a little bit of support. On average, people need coaching maybe 2 or 3 sessions, so it's not an ongoing dependence on the coach. It's just a way to get past the point where they're feeling like they have to take a supplement or they need to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars going to get IV treatments, etc., to heal.
I want to clarify, this can be an eventual do-it-yourself practice to generate new pathways in your brain. The neurons of the new pathways will light up, and the neurons of the old pathways will die down.
Yes, they'll dim, and they'll wind up essentially being deleted because pathways that are not used, they're not viable anymore. They have no purpose. And sometimes when people are switching from old trauma pathways to new healthy pathways that they're creating when they do this process, they find that they would have like some flashback or maybe occasionally like a nightmare or something like that when they're first starting the process, because those old pathways do think that they are helping us by reminding us of trauma. The other thing that I've discovered in my own healing is work with a therapist with EMDR for trauma. But if I hadn't done the neural retraining methods, the limbic rewiring methods first, I really wouldn't have had the kind of soft cushion of new pathways that I created of joy to land on whenever the old ones were kind of touched upon in order to try to get all that trauma out of the cortex of the brain.
Amazing, courageous work, Heather, and I'm glad to hear that you not only helped yourself with this technique, but you're actually helping others. It's really good to hear this. Can you give listeners the Facebook title again so they could go visit you?
I'm on Facebook. My profile is Heather Lane, and the profile for the Limbic Retraining Coach is Heather Lane, L-A-N-E, Limbic Retraining Coach, and they should be able to find it easily enough there.
Well, good work. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit In Other News Radio for archives and more information about the guests.